I think the problem with insurance is it gives you a false sense of security then, and then you don't take the necessary steps to really protect your assets because you say, oh, I've got insurance, so I can put six properties in one LLC. But the question is, do you know what that policy covers and what it doesn't cover?
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show, Passive Income Pilots. My name is Ryan Gibson. My co-host, Tate Duryea, is actually doing some laps in the simulator. I'm sure by right now he's on fire, had a hydraulic failure, and his landing gear collapsed on landing, and he is getting put through the ringer in the simulator, so he couldn't join me today. However, I have the one and only attorney, Clint Coons, from Anderson Advisors. Clint, how are you doing?
Ryan, I'm doing awesome. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Great to have you. Clint is one of the founders of Anderson Advisors, and we've had your partner on a couple of times, Toby Mathis. And he talked to us all about tax savings, tax strategy, depreciation, things like that. We're going to switch gears a little bit on this show and talk all about asset protection, LLCs, what do you need, what do you not need, and some strategies that go into basically protecting yourself from lawsuits and potential liability issues. And I just want to say I've worked with Clint personally over the past, 6-7 years. To help us restructure our organization and sort of get everything kind of in place for our asset protection here at Spartan. So great to have you, Clint. Why don't you just give us a little bit of background about who you are and kind of who you help and kind of your ideal client?
Well, you're my ideal client, obviously. I mean, obviously. Once I structured you, I hit it. You know, that was it. I was done. I quit. All right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So just, you know, to be brief, as you stated, attorney set up Anderson Business Advisors with my partner, Toby Mathis, and we started it, had a few employees, and we grew our firm up to 500 employees. And we sold a big portion of it to a private equity group that has come in and helped us then grow the business or growing the business even more. And so along this journey, we've been active real estate investors. And what I've learned, you know, even, you know, just growing our own portfolio now to, I don't know, over 600 doors, we're invested with you or in a couple of your projects and syndications. And there's a lot that goes into planning, you know, and what we look at here at Anderson, and I've discovered along my journey, is that, you know, asset protection and tax planning, you know, those are just two legs of a three-legged stool. That people forget about. There's also that business planning side, and you learn this as you're developing your real estate. That there are things you can do differently with your portfolio, with your single family investments, whatever it is, to make yourself look better to lenders. If you have a business side gig that you're looking to start up, how you position that so you can look better to lenders, or if you, like in my case, when somebody comes in and they offer you gobs of money and they want to become partners with you, you've set yourself up so you can close on that deal and minimize taxes. And at the same time, you've increased the attractiveness of your business. So there's so many different aspects that all roll up into what we do. It's what still keeps me here today.
Yeah, that's great. And one thing that you said was you do deals yourself. And that's why, that's why we transact and do business together. It's because you're not just out there preaching this stuff. You're actually out there buying real estate, transacting with private equity, and doing deals that you know what it's like. You know, when you set up an LLC, all the downstream impacts or what real asset protection look like. You're not just doing it for clients. So I think that's really unique. We obviously both have businesses that have multiple entities and a pretty robust asset management accounting structure. But let's put ourselves in the shoes of a pilot who might be holding a few rental properties right now and not quite sure if they have their asset strategy or their tax planning strategy together. What would be kind of the top, one or two things that you would want to make sure that they have at a minimum viable product in their portfolio for protection?
Well, you know, first off, I would say first thing that I have to have is accurate and not only accurate, but relevant information about what it is they're doing. You know, being here on this type of podcast, listening to the two of us talk about how to put together a plan for your investing is important because, you know, when we start building this, we want to make sure that we're doing it the right way. And there's a lot of detractors out there, a lot of people that will tell you, oh, don't worry about that. Just load up on insurance. Or that's not the way I'm doing it. I've done it this way. And this is the way I've been told to set things up. And the problem is that a lot of this information tends to come from people that are not investing or they're not doing what you're doing. And so when I look at someone who's just getting started and I say, you know, what can we explore as far as how do we protect you? It's to start with this premise in mind is that the plan that I'm going to put into effect should ensure that if something were to happen to me in my personal life, let's say that a claim's brought against me from some employee that's in the back and they say, oh, he did this or he did that. And it doesn't matter whether or not it's factual or not. Now you're embroiled in this lawsuit and claims are coming at you. You want to ensure that your assets are tied down and protected, you know, from those types of claims. But on the flip side, you also want to ensure that nothing like that occurs in your life, but something happens with the assets you're investing into, like real estate, that all of a sudden doesn't impact your personal life or your career because you're being sued as a result of somebody being injured on a piece of property. There was an MD that posted this question to me not too long ago. She said, hey, I got this tenant that came, a friend of a tenant came onto my rental property, he blew his hand off with a firework, and now I've been sued and I've been dropped from my insurance. And I'm, you know, what do I do? Those aren't the types of situations we want to be in. So what we typically then will look at as far as planning is concerned is using entities such as land trusts or limited liability companies and start separating out your liability exposure to minimize that across the board to ensure that if something does go wrong in any facet of your life, that all this effort you've put in to wherever you're at in your career and in your investing isn't going to be jeopardized.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, pilots have a lot to protect against. They put a lot into their careers and they have now great contracts that pay them very well. And so I think if you're going to dabble in real estate, it's a very lucrative thing to do, but you got to make sure that somebody can't cross over and come at you personally. One thing that I always hear from people is, you know, I got to get my LLC started before I get going. And it kind of drives me crazy a little bit because it's like, you don't really need an LLC to get going. You can buy a property without an LLC. Can you kind of like, how would you handle that sort of cloudiness of someone not taking the first step because they feel like they need their LLC first? And for some reason, that's a big cloud in their mind.
You're just cutting into my business. Doesn't matter if you ever buy a property, you still need an, everyone needs an LLC. Your point's well taken. And that is part of the problem is that, again, talking about information as you brought up, when you hear you need to set up an LLC before you start investing, that really doesn't address the relevancy of what you're doing. Because a lot of people, when they start investing, they are financing deals. So if you're going to finance a deal, then you're typically using Freddie Fannie underwriting guidelines because you're using a qualified mortgage lender. And that's, you know, like a Wells Fargo or someone like that. And those loans prohibit you from closing in an LLC because it's residential property. An LLC is a business entity. So even if you were to go set one up today for that deal that comes tomorrow that you're going to finance, you couldn't close in it. So there's never a rush. And when I tell investors that plan to buy this way, you know, where do you set up your LLC? Well, I need one. Where do you want me to set it up? They say, well, I've heard great things about Wyoming. Clint, you talk about that, or Delaware or Nevada. Why not one of those states? Well, because you're not buying in those states, are you? Because if you are buying, I could see why we would set it up there. But if you're buying in North Carolina or Texas, there's no point to set it up there to hold title to property in Texas. You might as well set up a Texas LLC. And then if you haven't acquired the property yet and you're going to use financing, let's make sure your money's gone hard, that you passed your inspection period, and then we can get it set up. And after you close, we can move the property into the LLC. Now, on a different spectrum, when it comes to investing, if you're buying for cash, Well, then that makes sense. Yeah, set up the LLC so you can make the offer in the limited liability company. You can close in the LLC. That's when I would consider using it at the outset, or even if you're investing in syndication. Many times I'll tell people, listen, if you want some extra protection on your investment in a syndication, set up the LLC and make the investment through the LLC, or make the investment and then call up Ryan and say, hey, move it into my LLC. I mean, I invested through, we have a couple of LLCs we invested into your various syndications through. So that's how we did it. And that's my recommendation to people.
Yeah, and that's really important because financing strategy plays into how you want to structure yourself, because you don't want to make yourself not financeable by the lender. Right. And that might not be the lender's preference, but it might just be the matter of an FHA loan, you know, can't go into a business entity for, you know, for a property or whatever it might be. Now, commercial banks, you know, local banks next door, if that's your strategy is to call, you know, the bank down the street from the rental property, like we finance our self-storage facilities, they will lend to your LLC. So, you know, that might be a consideration. So going back to what Clint said in the beginning, what is your business plan? You know, what are you planning to do? How are you planning to finance your properties? How are you planning to structure your entire organization? And that's what Clint did with us at Spartan, is he got first an understanding of how all of our businesses and subsidiaries are set up to come up with the best tax strategy to kind of lay it out. Let's talk to you know, somebody who might not be active investing, you know, they're sort of being more passive. Maybe they might do one or two syndications. Maybe they buy one or two rental properties. They're kind of limiting their journey a little bit. You know, what would you say kind of the minimum things are for that investor, and how can you help them in their structuring?
Yeah, so I would say the first thing you need is an estate plan. And that's something that gets often overlooked, because people, you know, they get excited about LLCs because of that fear of being sued. And so they want to protect themselves and from lawsuits and protect their assets from lawsuits. But the reality is, one guarantee in life is you're going to pass away. And then what's going to happen to the syndication interest that you hold, or those few properties that you made an investment into? Who's going to take control of those? And how easy is that going to be for them to insert themselves and get the funds that are necessary to keep their, you know, your family unit still working? So I will start with a living trust. I think that's the most important foundational tool that anyone creates. And then from there, I look at taking those assets and then breaking them apart into what we call safe assets and dangerous assets. So a syndication, it's a safe asset from the standpoint that if something happens with that self-storage facility, let's say that someone is cooking meth in one of the units. And I know you do a really good job of getting, you know, taking a cut off of anything they make, and then you provide better ventilation services. So I'd say if I am joking. Don't listen to what Clint said there. You can't trust that. He's a lawyer. What's the difference between lawyer and liar? Pronunciation. So the point is that if something did happen and that facility exploded and people are injured, I, as the investor, I'm not getting tagged on that deal. So what we're looking to do there is protect our syndication, the interest we hold, and our cash. These are safe assets. My interest in the syndication, that doesn't create liability for me. So I want to ensure that if I get sued personally, that it's going to be protected from my personal creditors. So those distributions, you know, that you, every month and quarter, when those come down, they're not going to be made available if you're involved in a lawsuit. A creditor can swoop in and take those. And so that covers our safe assets. You set up one LLC, put your syndications into there, put your savings. If you have a personal brokerage account, throw it all into that one company. It's fine. Its purpose is to protect those assets from your personal creditors. Now, with the dangerous assets, the real estate, that's a different animal. That is going to create liability for you. I mean, you know, your tenants, as I showed you, blow their hands off, or the house burns down. We had two houses burned down last year in Texas. We've had a tree fall through our properties before, one of our houses before, and narrowly missed the master bedroom. So those types of occurrences, if people are injured, they're going to sue the owner. And I don't want to be holding on to that property. So I'm going to have that property held in a limited liability company. And the question always becomes, well, if I got two properties, do I need two LLCs? You do. And people wonder, well, why would he tell me to do that? And I'll tell you why, because it's the same thing I do for my daughter. She has four properties and she has four limited liability companies because it took a lot of effort of her saving money to build up the assets where she could go out and buy her first property. And the last thing I'd want to do is on her second property, something go wrong and somebody sues. And instead of losing just one property, she loses both because they're in the same limited liability company. So I would advise people to separate out those assets, hold them in separate LLCs. So what happens in one won't affect number two over here. And then as you start growing, you know, like where we're at now, you get to a point where you can take on more risk. All right. So, you know, where I'm at with over 300 properties, I don't have 300 LLCs. I don't need it any longer. I can put 10 properties in a limited liability company and I can take on that risk because if I lose 10, I have 290 still producing income for me. So it's not the same impact in my life as if I only had three properties and I lost all three at the same time.
That makes sense. And you mentioned earlier, people ask where to put the LLC. Do I put it in Wyoming or Delaware? Pick that apart a little bit. Where would you set up those LLCs on those four rental properties in that example?
Well, generally speaking, we're going to set them up in the state where the property is located. But the thing about investing, it's not a one size fits all approach in that if you're investing in Texas, maybe that looks like a series LLC. Or if you're investing in Florida, we're not using LLCs in Florida. We're going to use a land trust in Florida to avoid transfer tax issues. And so depending on where the investment is being taken down, we're going to create a structure that is attuned to that state that will provide you the asset protection, but not create any adverse tax consequences on the funding of the LLC with the asset. So, I talk about LLCs a lot, but it gets granular.
Yeah. So you mentioned transfer tax. I want to pull on that thread. Can you kind of dive into what that means and what you're trying to prevent when you put a Florida asset into a land trust versus an LLC?
Yeah. So good friend of mine from Gig Harbor, attorney. And
by the way, lots of pilots live in Gig Harbor. So
I know they do.
Clint lives in Gig Harbor.
You know how you know
a pilot in Gig Harbor is you see a middle-aged man mowing the grass at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. And that's how you know.
Exactly.
Sorry.
With a highball in his hand. Anyways, he had a client, hopefully not a pilot, had a second property down in Florida and an investment property, set up a limited liability company for him, and then assisted in deeding the property into the LLC. Well, 2 months later, the client receives a bill for the transfer of that property from the client's name into this LLC. And a buddy calls me up, Clint, what's going on here? Have you ever come up, encountered this before? I said, not me. He goes, I can't believe it. You do so much business all over, you know, in all 50 states, and this has never come up. I said, it's never come up because I never do what you did right there. And that is to take an asset that has a mortgage on it, which is his case was this residential real estate, and put it in a limited liability company. Because in Florida, whenever you transfer real estate that's encumbered, it's subject to dock stamps, which is essentially a tax on the value of the debt of the property. And so, and unfortunately, you made that mistake and you're going to end up paying that bill, I would assume. What you should have done is use a land trust because a land trust is exempt from that tax. And there are different states. I mean, I was just dealing with Tennessee this morning with my assistant talking about moving property into LLCs to qualify for, in Tennessee, it's called the Fonts exemption to avoid franchise taxes in that state. And a lot of people don't realize that if you set up an LLC, you have to do it in a very special way in order to avoid having that LLC taxed on an annual basis. And I can think of a Florida client that I saved $45,000 a year going forwards just by restructuring the way his Florida CPA had structured his investments in Tennessee, because he was taking the approach he might use in Florida for his clients and applied it to Tennessee. And it works from an asset protection standpoint, but from a tax standpoint, it was all screwed up. So you want to balance all that in your planning.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note too, that it might even depend on the jurisdiction or the county that you're in. So having an attorney to guide you through this, who again, invests in real estate themselves and has done this for multiple clients, it really plays, pays dividends on that. Let's go one layer deeper. You mentioned the notion that there's a benefit to Delaware, Nevada, or Wyoming for certain types of LLCs. I know that we're set up at Spartan with Delaware LLCs for some of our assets. And then obviously in the states in which we do business in, we set up individual LLCs for our properties. Talk to why somebody would want to set up in Delaware or Wyoming or Nevada versus doing it in their home state.
So a client that lives in California, there's a judgment entered against my client for $1.7 million last year. And, you know, it's California. They're just, all their laws are screwed up, and they passed ridiculous law that was retroactive 2 years. And it stated that my client's independent contractors should have been employees 2 years going back. But everyone runs them as independent contractors besides in California. They said no longer can they be independent contractors. And because they weren't employees 2 years prior to this law's enactment, you owe taxes on all their wages. And you can be sued. So he got sued, and they get this judgment against him for $1.7 million. And I'd been working with him for a good 8-9 years, and we'd created structures that LLCs in California that rolled up into a Wyoming or various Wyoming limited liability companies. And the reasoning for this was twofold. One, we wanted to take his name off of all of his business interests. So if you looked up my client's name, you wouldn't be able to figure out what he owns because his name isn't associated with it. It's in an LLC. And if you were to look up the LLC, my client's name's not associated with that limited liability company either, because it points to a Wyoming limited liability company. And Wyoming doesn't collect any information on the owners or managers of LLCs. So we made them essentially appear judgment proof. So any creditor looks at my client and they think, oh, there's deep pockets there. And then they run an asset search, they're going to find nothing. They're going to think, oh, well, that was a mistake. He doesn't have anything. And the reason why we want to create this fiction is we want to discourage people from bringing shakedown claims against it. Well, it didn't work in this context because this was a laydown claim that, you know, the attorneys brought, and they got a judgment against him for $1.7 million. And he's all concerned. He has to go into this debtor's exam. And he said, Clint, they're going to ask me what I own. I said, yeah, they are. Well, they don't know right now. Do I have to disclose? They said, yeah, definitely. Tell them everything you have and exactly how we set it up. So you fast forward. He did just that. 2 hours in, after they listened to this, they shut off the cameras. They went outside. They did a sidebar. They came back in, kept the cameras off because there was three attorneys involved in this situation. And they looked at him. They said, well, you owe us $1.7 million, but based on the way you're structured, would you be willing to settle for $400,000? Nice. And he calls me. In fact, this went down at the best ever when I was there at the best. Yeah, the best ever. So I was going back and forth and talking to him. And he calls me, goes, what do I do? And I said, don't take that deal. And he was shocked. I said, this is a negotiation. That's our opening offer. We're not going to accept that. And so it went lower. Why was he able to walk away for less than $400,000 on a $1.7 million judgment? Because the other side appreciated the difficulty that the Wyoming LLC is going to pose to their recovery efforts, that they wanted to get paid. And in order to get paid, they would be behind him as far as the only times that monies would ever go to the creditors, if he decided to take money out of his LLC. And of course, you're never going to take money out of your Wyoming LLC. If you're told you have to pay it to a creditor, you're just going to hold on to it and keep investing it and growing it and wait 7 years for that thing to expire and then start pulling money out. Attorneys know this. And they know that in Wyoming, their options are limited just to get what's called a charging order. And that's the only remedy available. Had that been reversed and we had a bunch of California LLCs in my client's name, they would have known what he had before they went into the debtor's exam. They would go right after the LLCs, foreclose on his interest, and take $1.7 million. But by using the benefits that certain states offer us, like that's why you set up in Delaware, you can then use that effectively if you ever find yourself in that situation like my client was last year, and then you walk away and with a, you know, a victory essentially.
Nice. I mean, yeah. So is it Delaware versus Wyoming? What's the difference? Why Wyoming for one and Delaware for another?
Wyoming's less expensive. So that's going to be the positive there. If you want to go, you're going to raise money, you're going to work with commercial lenders, Wyoming's not going to be your friend. They're going to want Delaware because Delaware has some fiduciary obligations that are built into their LLC statute that makes lenders feel more comfortable in loaning to Delaware limited liability companies over Wyoming LLCs. And so whenever there's any type of funds that's going to be set up or commercial lenders, they'll be able to just go straight to Delaware. I've been involved in that situation. Private equity goes to Delaware. When we were financing a 40 pack we did in Houston, and the lender refused to do the deal if it was in the Wyoming LLC. They forced us to go to Delaware and set up a Delaware limited liability company to take that deal down. And that was years ago. And so it really started me thinking about this. And that's why, you know, we direct people different ways based upon the type of deal that they're getting into.
Yeah, I think that's so important. Before I met you, I was given some bad advice, and I was living in Seattle. I bought a rental property in Philadelphia. I was doing the whole buy a rental property on every layover. That ended after about the third one. But I really wanted to get into storage and commercial. Mm-hmm. But it was owned by a Wyoming entity. It was a Pennsylvania LLC that, you know, was wholly owned by the Wyoming entity. And I'll never forget calling a lender and saying, I want to get this loan. And the lender said, okay, so let me get this straight. You live in Seattle. You manage this remotely. You have a Wyoming LLC that 100% owns this Pennsylvania LLC on this property that you live 3,000 miles away from, or whatever it was. He was like, I'm going to go ahead and pass on this one.
Yeah.
So you got to be really careful about, you know, as much as you want to build the fortress around your empire with all these LLCs and entities, you got to make sure you're talking to the people that know what they're doing and understand the downstream effects. And I think that's kind of what you're getting after. So,
well, that's that business planning leg that I refer to, you know, in our overall planning strategies, is you have to know the right questions to ask of the client to figure out where they want to go with their investing. And then you design the strategy around it. So you back into it. You don't start on the front end and say, if you build it, they'll come, because I don't know where you're going to go with it. Tell me where you want to be, and then I can create a strategy around it that's going to facilitate you getting to that point, because entities can help you do more when it comes to even financing if you set them up the right way, or you can really hurt yourself with your entity planning, like you just described.
You probably work with pilot clients, and we're special people. We like to think so. What would you say are the top things that we get wrong? What are things that, you know, when you come in and you pop the hood on our situation, what would you say are kind of things that you constantly advise us and say, oh my God, you know, okay, here we go. Another typical pilot coming in, and they need to get these things fixed up in their portfolio.
Well, it's what I've started with or talked about earlier. The first thing is the estate plan.
Yeah.
By large, I would say about 60 to 70% of them that I sit down with don't even have a plan in place. And those that do, it's typically a will. And, you know, and a lot of times that will was the free one they got if they're coming out of the service. And that's what they still have with them. So it's putting together an estate plan is the most important step. That's where we start with.
You mentioned a will. I actually want to pull on that thread a little bit. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between a will and an estate plan?
Well, the difference is that with a will, someone like me is going to get paid after you die. With an estate plan, I'm not eating, okay? Because I'm not involved in that scenario. My grandfather's attorney for 50 yeah. years in Bremerton. And he did put together a lot of wills, and he's real creative at the time, because he'd always give the client the copy, never gave him the original. And his pitch was, hey, I'm going to keep your original here for safekeeping. You know, if you got a flood, you move, your house burns down, burglarized, you'll never worry, that I'll always have the original. Well, it was done specifically to ensure that when that person passed away, the beneficiaries came to his office because they had a copy, and their copy stated who the attorney was that drafted it, my grandfather picked up these probates. And that's the only way you can pass on assets to your heirs is through the probate process that is going to be handled by an attorney. And it's not inexpensive and it can tie up assets. So, you know, the people that you need or want to have your assets, it can take a while for them to get distributed down. So if you want more control and you want immediate access in the hands of your beneficiary, your spouse, if something were to happen to you, you set up a living trust because it bypasses a probate process. And think of a big box, like a pod, you know, that you use for moving, put everything into that pod, then your spouse is in control of it and they takes that pod and go wherever they want. They don't have to go through any court proceedings, nothing. And they can pull assets out of it, distribute out to beneficiaries per the terms of that trust, and everything inside of that pod is going to be protected. So
yeah, great,
that's
great
point. Biggest difference.
Yeah. I mean, so it's like ironclad versus mushy. And yeah, you know, you've written down where you want things to go, but it's subject to interpretation and attorney. So you heard the charge. Let's get those attorneys. Let's make those attorneys starve. Let's not.
I'm not a friend of a lot of attorneys when I talk about estate planning. Even my friend in Gig Harbor. He's like, no, people need wills. I'm like, okay, I know.
Yeah, exactly. So I was thankful enough to set up my estate plan last year. It wasn't a pain-free process. It took a little while. It was something that my wife and I, every night, we like plugged away at it for like an hour, just, you know, what we want to do and all these confusing terms. So, but you know, the folks at Anderson can help you kind of work through that. And obviously there's a little bit of an upfront charge on an estate plan or a will or a trust, I should say. And there's also like work to do after you set it up. You've got to transfer your interests and your investments or set up your beneficiaries to be directed to your living will and trust. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit about that kind of transition?
Yeah, you want to make sure it's fully funded. So any accounts you have, you want to make sure that they're either owned by the trust or they're the beneficiary on the account. So when something happens to you, they're automatically in control of your successor trustee or your spouse when you pass. And a lot of confusion stems from even bankers. I remember I was just in at the Wells Fargo 3 weeks ago, my wife and I, and we had an account still in our name. And the banker said, well, you don't have to change it over your trust. You know, we could just list your kids as the beneficiaries on this account. And then when you pass on, it goes right to them. My wife said, oh, that sounds like a great idea. I said, yeah, the hell it does. You think that the kids are going to get the money in this one account immediately? If you and I were to take an accident tomorrow and die, I said, our trust doesn't give it to them. Why would we allow the banker to give it to them? And so that's what happens a lot of times. They make it seem like, oh, this is the best way to do it. And reality is you want all that in your trust. So you want to get your accounts changed over. And so in that case with Wells, all they did was just change the account name. Now, when I went into Chase, their process is you have to open up a whole brand new account in the name of your trust. Because a lot of times those bankers they're incentivized by how many new accounts they're opening. So I think there's a bonus pool there. It's a pain in the ass, right? Do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you have to make sure that all your assets are retitled. And one of the things that we do here at Anderson for you is that if we set up LLCs, we're going to ensure that all those business interests are in there. So when you think about it, your LLC that you set up that has your brokerage account, your savings account that you put inside of there, maybe, I mean, I use mine. I've been buying treasuries and CDs and I have that in the same LLC. And then my syndication interest is in there. Well, all of those assets that are held in that one LLC, all I have to do is put the LLC into my trust and then all that flows into the trust. I don't have to change anything else because that's already been changed. So we assist with that whenever we set up our LLCs for our clients. You know, this LLC owns a piece of property in Florida, or not Florida, bad example, in Philadelphia. Well, then by putting the LLC into the trust, that property is also held by the trust.
Yeah, it's really important. And, you know, and I would say probably the biggest name transfer that I get as a syndicator is, you know, investors start in their personal name. They make the investment, not a big deal. And then, you know, a year or two later, if they set up their estate plan or their living trust, they'll come back to us and say, hey, I just set up a living trust. I want to transfer my interest and my syndication into that living trust. And so we take care of the paperwork and do all that stuff. And I know that you and I had connected on that a couple of years ago at the Best Ever Conference. and making sure that we do it correctly. And there's a process that we follow and all that stuff. So that's really good. Kind of want to shift gears a little bit to maintenance, you know, annual maintenance and doing the, making sure that the LLC is actually a good status so that it actually is viable. And, you know, obviously you can set it up, but then there's some ongoing things that you have to do to maintain it. Can you kind of talk through that?
Yeah. So what I tell people, don't worry about it. When you set it up with us, we're going to handle that for you and maintain it on an annual basis because it's really low value work for you. Right. Do you want to be monitoring when your entity has to be renewed, any forms that need to be filed to renew that entity? If you move, you want to be responsible to update the state so your entity doesn't become administratively dissolved because you're missing the annual filings that are due because they're sending it to the old address and, you know, that buyer of your property is just trashing them. So I tell people that, you know, if you're not using us, use somebody to monitor it for you so that you don't screw that up. I mean, because there's not a lot that goes on with maintaining a limited liability company. It's not like a corporation where you're engaging in an active trader business. And so you have to have resolutions and meeting minutes and things like that. It's just basically making sure all the necessary filings have been completed on an annual basis to ensure that it stays compliant with the state where it's been set up. Now, at the same time, are there little things that do come up? Absolutely. When you're investing with an LLC, maybe, you know, a title company may ask for resolutions or lender might ask for a resolution. And so those are things that we incorporate into our services as well for our clientele, where we draft those to provide, to make sure that deals can get done and they don't hold up, you know, the closing on a piece of property. Those little, there are some things that take place between the bookends, you know, when you start it and when, at the end of the year, that happen on occasion. But by and large, it's just making sure that it stays in compliance. And we run into a lot of people that will tell us, I have a limited liability company already set up. Can you incorporate that into my plan? Oh, absolutely, I can. And when our staff will pull up the LLC, at least 35% of them are administratively dissolved. That means that LLC is dead. And any assets that are held inside of it, you've just created a title problem for us, because now the question is, how do you get that out of a dead entity? Sometimes you have to try to resurrect it, and that can cost $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 in late payments and in fees, if it's even possible. If it's not possible, then it becomes more of sleight of hand to fix that problem through some creative planning strategies so it doesn't show up as a black mark on title when you go to sell. And they say, oh, well, that entity was, it died 10 years ago and you don't have authority to sell this property because the entity is no longer in existence.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, just again, use the professionals to help keep your stuff in good standing and good working order. And, you know, it also helps too, where on the fly, if you get asked to do something, like you said, like a closing resolution to buy property, whatever it might be, it's kind of like you guys are right there to sort of handle that that nuance and as experienced business operators and owners of real estate as well. So let's talk about insurance. One thing that people always say is the best or the first line of defense is a good insurance policy. Can you kind of speak to how you help clients or how you would advise a client on how they would set up insurance, maybe on rental properties?
Yeah, so you're going to get a landlord policy and you're going to either list the entity as a named insured, or you're going to list it as an additional insured under the policy. So maybe you stay the named insured and then you put your LLC as the additional insured. And that's going to be driven by the carrier themselves on how they typically set up those types of policies. One of the companies that I refer a lot of people to when they get started in real estate investing, they have a few properties, is National Real Estate Insurance Group, because that's who they work with. They're just real estate, or Chubb. They work with real estate investors. And so it's really simple to set up your policies. It's important. You got to have it. Okay. That's it. Yeah. If you think you set up a business entity, oh, I got asset protection, I don't need insurance. Well, you're definitely going to get sued because that's a requirement, even though you have entities. But I think the problem with insurance is it gives you a false sense of security then. And then you don't take the necessary steps to really protect your assets because you say, oh, I've got insurance, so I can put six properties in one LLC. But the question is, do you know what that policy covers and what it doesn't cover? And a lot of the claims that end up being brought against real estate investors many times aren't even covered under your policy. you know, the claims that you're most worried about now are those, you know, discrimination claims that tenants will bring against you because you didn't rent them the property. And they said you did it because they, you know, fill in the blank, whatever they'd identify as at that point in time. And that's why you chose not to rent them the property. It wasn't the fact that they were lighting up a crack pipe and walking through your house, because that's not relevant. All right. You can't judge somebody by what type of crack they smoke. So this all falls back onto us, and you wonder, why do you want to buy rental real estate? So you have to make sure that you recognize this, you know, environmental contamination, toxic mold, that's not even covered under there, or constructive eviction. You know, I had one client 2 years ago during the pandemic. This is the type of BS that some of these states and cities were throwing down on landlords. They wouldn't allow them to evict the tenant. Tenant sat on the property, was destroying the property, lived there for a year and a half until they lifted the moratorium. Then the city billed him $4,000 or $5,000 for the utility usage by that tenant. He said, he wouldn't let me evict him. He wasn't paying me rent, and I'm responsible for providing him for utilities. They said, yep. Guess what? His insurance didn't pay that claim. He didn't get covered under that. It came out of his pocket. So when you think that your insurance is going to cover everything, it's not. What it's for is this. It's to say to your guy that's suing you, hey, man, I'm so protected. You're not going to collect anything. Take my policy limits and leave me alone. Because if you go beyond, if you try to fight this, my policy is going to get spent down fighting you. And today you've got $300,000 available. 2 years from now or a year from now, it might be $150,000. So where do you want to go with this? And that strategy is really effective. I have seen my clients, we've used it a few times. And I remember the one case, it was a $15 million claim that was being brought against one of my clients, and they walked away with their $1 million policy limits, and they kept all their assets.
That's great. Last thing I want to touch on is the tax return. You know, when I was new to real estate investing, I'd always hear this term, well, your LLC is a disregarded entity. And I had no idea what that meant. And, you know, tax season came around and my accountant would start yapping at me, you know, do you have any disregarded entities? Do you have any LLCs? Well, I have all these LLCs that I set up for my rental properties, whatever it might be. And what kind of goes into that tax preparation? Kind of explain that to me like I'm in second grade.
Well, I mean, a lot of people out there are going to confuse you on this. A lot of bankers don't even understand it. A disregarded LLC does not have to, it's ignored, doesn't have to file a tax return. You tell the IRS, hey, this entity, it's a business entity, give me an EIN number, but it will not file a return. The owner of the company is going to be responsible for all the taxes associated with this company. So when we're creating entities and a plan for someone, the vast majority of the entities that we create, LLCs, are disregarded. They don't have to file tax returns. And so this belief that, hey, if you set up seven LLCs, your tax return is going to get uber complicated. It's just not true. It's not reality, because those LLCs, if you set them up all as disregarded, your tax return is going to look exactly the same tomorrow after the LLCs are set up as it did last year or as it does today. So when we're creating it, we like to set up and keep it as simple from the tax planning standpoint. But we do give our clients the opportunity to consider having a holding company, meaning we'll set up, if you have a few properties, say you had four or five properties, I would have those four or five LLCs all held by one Wyoming LLC for anonymity and for asset protection purposes. But more importantly, it's for some tax planning, business planning purposes. And that is, I'm going to have that Wyoming LLC be treated as a partnership, so it will file a tax return. And the reason I do that is because I got lost a deal because of my tax return. Because when I went in to get a loan, they looked at my return and they said, you don't qualify. You don't make enough money. I'm like, the hell I don't. I said, look at my rental income. They said, well, yeah, that's not enough. I said, what do you mean it's not enough? Because I kind of knew what the debt to income ratio was going into this deal and I had enough money. Well, they held back 25% of my income from my rental activity. They would not count it. I was like, why aren't you counting this money? And they said, well, we can't count that because we're underwriting this with Freddie Fannie and their underwriting requirements require us to hold back this amount of income in the calculation for vacancies. And so even though it was on my tax return, they ignored it. And so that lender backed out and 11th hour, and I lost this opportunity for this property because of the way my tax returns look. And so then I realized, you know, and I was talking to the guy, he said, you know, had this been on a 1065, if you had this on a partnership return, a 1065, and that was a K-1, I'd be in a different position because the underwriter would give you 100% of that income. But because you kept it on your Schedule E page one, meaning in your own name, disregarded status, my hands are tied. Sorry. And like, interesting. And so then going, yeah.
That's a ton of knowledge right there. I mean, that is worth replaying. I mean, just to summarize, like a Schedule E, like, a, you know, you and I are kind of flowing here. That's just like, if you have a disregarded, you know, so let's say you buy one rental property in Pennsylvania, you put it in a Pennsylvania LLC and you're in its disregarded entity. All that income is just going to fall on your personal tax return, your 1065, and it's all going to go under Schedule E, and all the expenses and revenue are going to land right there. It's just straight pass through. But what Clint is talking about is if you have this holding company that owns that asset, it's going to give a K-1, which is basically just a partnership profit and loss of distributions, right? And, and that's going to flow right to your tax return differently.
And so line item.
Yes, it's a line item, and the lender is going to look at you differently and count that income differently. That's a huge value add strategy there. So thank you.
Not to mention reduces your audit risk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good point. Yeah, absolutely. Because you're putting all your revenue and expenses on that Schedule E, right? So that, that kind of maybe opens you up for a little bit more dissecting. Is that why or some other reason?
So I learned this from a client that years ago, he said, I'd been practicing for 5 years and I met this guy in California and he had multiple LLCs and all by a holding company that was set up as a partnership. And I told him, you know, if you don't want to file a tax return, I don't file tax returns. I can set it up so you don't have to file a tax return. We'll just change the tax status. He said, well, that sounds great. That's going to save me X amount of dollars a year. But we did that. 2 years later, he got audited.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. I felt bad. And I got to see his CPA. He's still using a CPA at that time. Probably still is. And so we got on the phone and the CPA said, yeah, I told him he shouldn't have done this because this is what was going to happen. And the CPA, you know, he didn't hold it against me, but I didn't know what I didn't know. And he said, the CPA told me in his experience, what happens is that when all that shows up on your 1040 Schedule E, because it's held in your own name or through disregarded entities, if you're in a room of 100 auditors, 97 of those auditors are auditing 1040 Schedule E's, right? Because that's what they're allowed to do, audit individuals. And so when you're using real estate to maximize out the tax deductions that come from owning real estate, to wipe out your income, maybe wipe out the income you're generating from working with the airline as well, taking those accelerated depreciation, well, that could draw the scrutiny of an auditor. But if you stick that through a partnership, the way he said we used to have it, there's three guys that are qualified to audit that type of return. And there's so many of those returns out there, they just don't have the bandwidth. And so those returns don't get audited. Now, he came through his audit, no problem, but he had to go through that process. And it was my fault. I should have never made that recommendation. And after that, I never made it again. I tell people, hey, here's the pros and cons. You make that decision on your own. But it was reconfirmed. We have a few former IRS attorneys that work for us, and they'll tell you the exact same thing, that when they were there, the 97% of the people who are qualified to conduct audits can only conduct audits on 1040s. And if you're running a business or you have real estate, you want to run that through a partnership return so that you're taking yourself out of the risk of getting audited. I mean, even though the risk is low, who wants to go through it? You don't have to.
Exactly. Well, Clint, I appreciate you coming on. You've dropped a ton of nuggets on the show. I know that you have a YouTube channel, so I'm going to actually put that in the show notes if you don't mind. But how do guests get in touch with you?
Well, you can go to andersonadvisors.com and you can set up a strategy session there with one of our attorneys or business strategists, talk about your real estate investing. If you want to get educated, you can definitely go to my YouTube channel. Search my name, YouTube, my partner, Toby Mathis. He's got a great YouTube channel as well. Covers a lot on taxes. So yeah, you just put in our names in YouTube. You can't miss us.
That's great. And I know that you have a ton of subscribers and you always put out really valuable content. So I highly encourage you, check it out, get educated, put a lot of great stuff out there. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Clint.
And, Ryan, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
And fun.
Talk to you all on the next episode.